Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm a mom of three kids, ages 2, 5, and 7, and I live in Southern California.
And I'm Megan. I am the mom of 5 kids, ages 6 through 17, and I live in Michigan. This is the Mom Hour, part of the Life Listened Network. Hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 65 of the Mom Hour. I'm Megan Francis, here with Sarah Powers. And today, Sarah and I are going to do something we've, dabbled in doing a few times, which is answering listener questions. We get a lot of them, and sometimes they're not enough to, you know, do a whole episode around, but they're always really fun to answer. And so that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, we got some good ones. We got one that came in through SpeakPipe, which is where you can call in your question and you'll actually hear Becky's voice ask her question first up. And then we've got 2 more great questions. So keep sending your questions to us. We love getting them. We try to incorporate them in some way, almost every one. Some of them kind of get combined together or just conceptually added into the mix. But today we're going to go Dear Abby style on three of our listeners. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah. So let's start.
All right. Here's Becky's question.
Hi, this is Becky. I've been listening to your podcast for a while. I have 2 boys, 7 and 4. And I was just wondering if you guys maybe could talk a little bit at some point about times when your kids have had rough phases for various reasons. You know, there's always somebody going through something that's a little frustrating. Right now, my son, my older one, is going through a very anxious phase. He's always been a little tricky with napping, with sleeping, with tantruming. But he's just got this free-floating anxiety now. It comes up at bedtime. It comes up when he has to do something new, like go to camp or go swimming somewhere. He's never been swimming before. And it kind of becomes the center of everybody's attention. He gets worried. He can't do it. He kind of freezes up. And then he gets mad, or he has a tantrum, or he lashes out and hits his brother. And it goes up and down. But I just was thinking today, it would be kind of helpful to hear you guys talk about other phases, times where your kids have been challenging, how you got through it, what the other side of the very frustrating phase looked like.
Oh, Becky, we feel ya. This is a great question. And I think the bigger picture part of my answer, I think what we can focus on is how to kind of cope and deal when one of your kids is going through a really tough phase, which is the question she's asking. But I also have a son who is very tightly wound, I like to say, and super intense emotionally. And so I can more specifically relate to some of what Becky's talking about. And I know from an email that her son is 7. I don't know if that came through in her audio, but we are talking about a 7-year-old here. So I guess I'll just kind of offer my little story about Reed. Reed is 6 now, and is definitely would qualify for kind of anxiety-like behaviors, but he doesn't have a lot of fears, which is what I think of when I think of kids and anxiety. So it's taken me a while to kind of learn what that looks like for him and also manage my own worry about it. And that's been over the last year or so. So without just going into a lot of details about him, it's a lot of the same. I feel the same way that Becky does, in that it can really dominate your family and kind of your mindset as a mom, and almost to, if you have more than one kid, almost at the expense of your other kids, quite honestly. And number one, I think this is probably just normal. Like she said in her question, somebody's always going through something. I remember when I decided to have 3 kids, my mom was like, well, it's pretty much in a rotation. Like as soon as someone gets out of a crazy phase, whether it's the terrible 2s or teenage years, somebody else is going into something. So I mean, probably a lot of acceptance of knowing that somebody is always going through something. A lot of paying attention to your own needs, I guess, my own. I got pretty consumed by worry over the last year about Reed. And Reed is actually fine. He does fine in school. At this point, we're not needing any extra support for him, although that would be fine and great if we did. But I kind of like went to the like worst possible scenario when I started to see some anxiety and almost a little bit of like pre-OCD behaviors in him. And I just like in my mind, I was down this, you know, very scary path instead of as we know, staying in the moment, like what's the kid doing right now and how can I help him right now? So I don't know if Becky's doing any of that, kind of projecting. That again is more of, if you're a worrier, that's what worriers tend to do. But it's really helped me to remind myself all the time that I have what I need to help him right here today. And if things do get worse, or if we do need to get help, then we will do that. I also just know that anxiety and anxious phases go in big swings. I mean, I know you can probably talk about at least one of your kids, Megan, but it's not just little kids that can come back and ebb and flow.
Yeah, for sure.
Gosh, I'm all over the place.
Well, no, I think it's...
Bail me out, and then I'm sure I'll have more specific tips.
Well, one thing I was thinking about is, you know, how do you know the difference? I have a friend who's going through something very similar to Becky. Her son is older and has always had these problems. One of the questions that's in my mind is, how do you know when something is truly a phase or something is just a different manifestation? Clara has a lot of anxieties. I did not recognize them as anxieties until pretty recently because they didn't look that way. It looked like someone who talked a lot and asked a lot of questions. And what I finally realized is she gets stuck on some, like she'll ask permission to do something, but then she has to pose the question like five different ways.
Yeah.
I guess just to make sure I actually am okay with it. And I always thought that was just a kind of a cute quirk until other stuff kind of started coming together. And I thought, oh, this isn't really a phase. This is her. Right. And right now this is how it's coming out. I'm not sure it matters really, I guess, as long as, like you said, you take care of yourself, you take care of their needs that are in front of you right now. So, you know, if you need some kind of outside support, which this friend of mine actually has decided it's time for that. She was able to manage it for a long time. He's getting older. She's like, he needs more tools in his toolbox than I can give him. So I think that's another thing. Like, you know, we were talking about, I've had kids go through bratty phases. I had Owen went through a phase where whenever he didn't get his way, he would come up and ram me in the side with his head over and over. We had a phase with William where if we were out someplace, it's so funny because he's so steady now, but he went through a little phase where if he didn't get what he wanted, like in the store, he would just sit down and not move. And he could like turn his body into lead somehow. It became heavier than was possible. Like changed the gravitational force somehow underneath him. So we couldn't pull him out of the store. And that to me is like a phase, you know, that's like a truly, obviously he's not still doing that now. This was years ago.
Right.
Whatever the thing, the behavioral things are, or his personality that made that be the way he manifested that stage of his life, I guess is who he is. So that's not really helpful. I guess I'm just,
no, I think you know it is saying? Helpful. Yeah. I think it is helpful. And it's brought up a couple more ideas from me, which is, one thing that helps me with Reed is to look back historically and remember all of, because he has always been tightly wound. He's always been extremely inflexible, which again, like you're saying with Clara, I think of anxiety as worry in kids and fears, especially around like new situations or social situations or trying something new. And that Reed doesn't have a lot of those. He doesn't have bedtime anxiety either. So he doesn't fit the mold. What he has is a very rigid definition of how things should be. And he gets hyper attached to things like, well, to material objects. So he has a really hard time saying goodbye to anything. Like we've talked on this show about kids and, you know, they want to keep their artwork forever or a tchotchke from a goodie bag, but his is to the point of extreme. And then he has super picky eating tendencies, which I have learned also go along with some of these behaviors. But it does help for me, and especially if I dialogue with my husband, to look back and be like, oh, remember when he could not, like you'd tell him we need to go in 5 minutes and he would lose his mind. He had to have like a 20 minute warning, a 10 minute warning. You had to come sit by him and say, we're going to need to go to school. Like things like that. Those kinds of transitions were really hard and they're so much better now. So I think if you're a little bit concerned about where you are right now, if there has been improvement or growth, it can be a helpful reminder that like, okay, even with this kid, this, you know, tightly wound or intense kid, we've moved through these phases and we're probably always going to be moving through a phase. And then that's probably also a good, you know, check-in where if you really haven't, if you've been stuck in a pattern for what feels like too long and, you know, we have our gut and our instinct, then I think some kind of outside support or just talking to somebody who has experience. There's so many parents who have experience parenting kid. And I think with 6 and 7 year olds, we sometimes stop chit-chatting
about
what our kids are going through. You know, like everybody's going to talk about the latest tantrum or the sleep issues with little ones. But either we get embarrassed or we just think we're the only one. So
I think we start blaming ourselves as they get older. I think we start blaming ourselves. We think it's something that we're doing or didn't do. You know, it's easy to say a two-year-old is, you know, being a two-year-old.
Right.
But we don't really know what a seven-year-old looks like.
Right.
Like there's, you know, there's no classic things that are applied to that person. Yeah. Everybody, by that point, you think it becomes a product of parenting.
Right.
And we know that's not necessarily the case, right?
Right.
So I will also say that seven and eight – and we've talked about this before. I guess the episode we did a few weeks ago where we talked about ages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, stuff is going on at seven and eight. And I remember that. I think one thing I talked about was I remember really clearly being seven and eight. And that's one of the first ages I have really strong memories connected to. Mm-hmm. And I remember like a lot of things being very intensified in that at that age.
It's
sort
of
an age of awareness, you know?
Yep. I started to have a lot of fears at that age, I know, personally.
I remember worrying that I was going to swallow my tongue and I wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night because I thought I might accidentally swallow my tongue. I mean, it's just like an example of something that I would fixate on.
Right.
And, you know, I don't, you know, it just went away. I don't know how long it took, but I do remember that. There was a lot of that kind of stuff. There's just, they're so clued in at that age and like stuff is just happening really fast. So.
Well, we have a lot of access to great information we talk about. I talk about all the time on this show, which can be a blessing and a curse. I feel like about a year ago when I started noticing and kind of worrying about these things, I would get super triggered myself reading headlines online like picky eating tied to OCD in children. There are some ties to picky eating and some serious mental health disorders. I have a picky eater and I also have a fairly anxious child, but what it caused me to do was kind of like not pay attention to what was actually happening in my house and like put these other details on top of it, which is why I don't Google things. And I wasn't Googling things. I mean, I feel like there's people who Google health symptoms and people who don't. I do not. But it was coming to me in the parenting writing I was reading. And so I kind of had to like shut that off for a while and be like, we need to deal with the actual things happening in our house, not with what could.
You don't want to borrow. You don't need to borrow trouble.
Yes, I know. And again, this is a theme with me. But really quick, before I forget, I don't want to cut you off, is that there is one book that I keep hearing outstanding things about. And I might have even mentioned it on this show. And it's called The Opposite of Worry by, I believe it's Leonard. Oh, I'm going to have to look it up before we move on. I'll look it up. But and I've read another book of his and he's fantastic. And it deals with kids and fears and anxieties, and it's supposed to be great.
One other thing I wanted to mention that ties in with what you were just saying, Sarah, and I think really applies to like phase, no matter what phase your kid is in, is that you kind of touched on this already, but it's very tempting to kind of like try to head your kid off at the pass, like to assume if they're in a phase, they come in and I know this feeling because I've had it so many times where they walk in the room and already like my shoulders are tensing up because I just know it's coming. Whatever it is, there have been times I've sort of unfairly jumped the gun or sort of tried to talk them out of something before they even got into it. And I think it's important just for your kids, it's not fair to make assumptions, but for yourself, just to be in a peaceful place, to not always be like anticipating the worst or waiting for the other shoe to drop. Sometimes it won't. And at some point it'll stop probably, you know? So
we notice things just like anything, when you're clued into something, you hyper notice it. And so if you are, well, picky eating is a good example, and that's one that I have to work on with myself, is just sometimes I just need to sit on like another side of the table where I'm not paying attention to how much or how Rita's eating.
Yeah.
Because that's why like going back to school is great, because I'm like, I need you to eat a couple snacks and lunch away from me, because it may be an issue, but like having it in front of your face and then like you said, anticipating it or like watching it play out. And this brings me to another point I wanted to make sure we made, which is if you have other children, it really is. If the squeakiest wheel is going through a big thing, it's not that you're ignoring your other children, but you're sort of, your like parental energy is really dominated. And that's definitely kind of what was going on with us. And to me, it really just helped like by being mindful and being like, I'm going to think about Allegra right now. And just think about like, what's she doing in school? What phases is she going through? Like, how am I going to connect with her today? It sounds kind of silly. But I really, like, my pattern had gotten so stuck obsessing about Reed that I really had to, like, take my thoughts and redirect them to one of my other kids. And it was kind of helpful in a way. Like, I have three kids. You have five kids. They all need.
Well, and one other thing I wanted to mention, too, before we move on, is that if your kid is going through a phase that in any way is outward facing or public facing and you're embarrassed about it, mm-hmm. that can heighten it so much. But I will say every person I've ever known who, I mean, that's not true. Most cases when I've had a friend or an acquaintance whose kid is going through a phase, I'm not necessarily seeing what they're seeing.
Yeah.
They just look like a regular weird kid to me. Like kids are weird. They have quirks. Yeah. I kind of expect that. I think most people expect that. Right. So what might be really making you very anxious and is very surface for you when you're out and about probably doesn't look to other people the way it looks to you.
And
so you don't need to anticipate
their own kids anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always thinking about what my kid's doing. So you don't need to necessarily anticipate and try to head it off at the pass because you're so worried what other people are going to think. Probably it looks a lot more normal than you think.
Right.
Because like you said, it's like when you think everyone's thinking about you, but they're actually, everyone's thinking about themselves.
And then also before we leave, Becky, just for kind of advice is I think talking to parents whose kids have come through phases, which is what she's doing by asking us the question.
Good job, Becky.
Good job. But that is one thing I found helpful. And then talking to other adults who know your kid, teachers, coaches, that was really helpful to me. And I was almost embarrassed to ask his teacher, like, are you seeing this at school? I think what I was afraid she would validate it. And then I'd be really worried, like afraid of, you know, and instead, of course, what happened is she said, no, he's great in class. I'm not seeing any of those issues. And then I asked again at the conference and she said, I know what you mean. And she's a mom and she had a kid that was similar. And again, that was helpful to me. But when we worry, we can often worry very alone. So finding people whose advice you trust, you know, probably not just going to the wide open internet, but finding people whose advice you trust and asking their opinion, I think might help.
Yeah. Shall we move on?
All right, let's move on. So Claire sent us an email and I'm going to read it because it's sort of like a big messy, I'll set the context. It's a big extended family dinner at a restaurant. We've all been there. And Claire's child was the youngest of a big group of cousins that were at the restaurant. But I'll read her words because I think that's the best way to set the scene. She said, just this last weekend, we had a big family reunion. There were 7 kids total, ranging in ages from 18 months to 9 years old. Our expectation for our little boy is that he sits in a high chair, eats his food, and stays in the high chair until we are done. We also keep in mind he's little and has a short attention span, so when we do eat out, we make sure it's going to be not too long. At the family reunion dinner, there was a lot of catching up and talking with family, so dinner took a while. The other 6 kids were basically running around, being loud and in the way at the restaurant. Our little guy was seeing this and wanted down out of his high chair too, and when I did let him out, I was closely supervising him and basically supervising the other 6 kids as well while the parents enjoyed a nice, calm dinner in ignoring their kids. I guess my question is this. I don't want to parent the other 6 kids, but I do want to be absolutely sure my child isn't the one causing problems. Is this more an issue for me because my child was the youngest in the group, or should I have said something to my cousins so they were aware their kids were being in the way?
Oh boy, Claire.
It's a juicy one.
Hot topic.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to set the stage by saying I am pretty anal about restaurant behavior. Mm-hmm. So that's the context I'm coming from.
Okay.
I've worked in restaurants. I don't let my kids run around. They stay in their seats, period. And have always been that way. And I will say when they were really little, that means we didn't go out to eat a lot.
Yep.
So I'm kind of almost looking at this and thinking, oh my gosh, why are you having a big family reunion at a restaurant?
Right.
It just, it sounds like everyone's being
weekend.
Yeah. It sounds like it just sounds like a setup.
Right.
Right from the get go. That's not going to give anybody what they need necessarily. Right. So, I mean, that's not your fault, Claire. I'm just saying like, it just sounds like you just kind of wandered into a bad situation kind of. So, I mean, what do you do about it? That's the question. I think people know when their kids are running around. And I think people have different tolerance levels for that. And had it been me, and I've been in that situation before, I have made jokes before like, hey, guys, you know, or like you do the – it's either way, it kind of comes out kind of passive aggressive, right? Because you're doing the whole like, hey, little Cindy, you almost ran into that waitress, ha, ha, ha. And you're hoping the other parent's listening. And if they're not, then there's not a whole lot you can do, right? It's not your kid.
Right.
I guess I'm just not really sure – I don't know. There's no good answer here except to say I'm validating Claire's frustration and saying
it would be frustrating.
And it's not on you. Your kid being the youngest in the group doesn't make you any more culpable or responsible. Big kid can do just as much and maybe more damage running around. So
oh, definitely.
Yeah. I don't know, Sarah, where do you stand on that?
Okay. So I also expect pretty good behavior in restaurants because I also waited tables forever. Yeah. And just, I guess I'm not too picky about how my kids are at the table. I feel like they're pretty messy.
Me too.
We're semi-loud. But yeah, I would have, especially when you're in confined spaces, I don't like feeling like kids are in the way of servers. I guess in this situation, if it were me, and again, how we got to this situation is the different story, but I think it is because your kid is the youngest. You can't let an 18-month-old run off and play with the big kids. What I probably would do is, because I'm stuck being with my kid anyway, there's not an option really there. Right. I would probably approach one of the cousins and say, hey, I'm uncomfortable with how many kids there are right in this small space. Would it be okay if I took them outside, or one of you want to join me outside for a little bit? Yeah. Because then you kind of put it on yourself. Like, hey, I feel really bad. And you're not blaming any of the kids, but like, I feel bad for the restaurant that we're, you know, causing this scene in here, and I'm happy to take the kids outside. Would you help me? I don't feel comfortable watching six kids by myself. Or does somebody else want to come out with me and we can chat while the kids run around? So, so I guess I would say something, but not necessarily to correct the kids' behavior. Because here's the other side. I am, as we know, as we discuss often, I am entering into the phase where I am one of those people who can sit back, have a glass of wine, and let my kids play. Not that I would let them play right in a restaurant, but I am no longer the one bouncing a baby around at a restaurant. And it is really awesome. So I kind of empathize with, I mean, maybe her cousins are really good, conscientious parents, and just really for the first time were able to sit down and enjoy a conversation. And we're being like sort of benignly negligent because it felt really darn good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, like, I get that. I totally do. And I will say,
you just kind of like let the kids go because it's been 8 years since you've been able to do that. And poor Claire is not at that phase. So she has no choice.
She's
so
like, hey, I got no choice. You know, and I will say I have friends who have very active toddlers, and I'm not in that stage and have not been for a very long time. And Clara, even longer than Clara, because she was not a super active toddler. Right. She was easy at that kind of thing. So it's been a long time for me. But one of the ways I've sort of given back, I guess, paying it forward, is I will always be the one to pull that three-year-old in my lap and get out crayons and paper. I mean, I just feel like that's my duty as a parent who's been there to give my friends a break so they can enjoy their beer or whatever and not worry about their kid running around. John and I both do that. We're great at that. But at the same time, in the situation that Claire's describing, I just wouldn't be. I would have a really hard time with that. I would not be enjoying myself, so I would have to do something. You said, that's a great solution. Your solution is good. We could suggest we move on to a different venue maybe. Maybe like next time ask for a private room.
Right.
Pull out some crayons and paper and distract the kids. Get out a tablet. I mean, there's options in this case. And I think, you know, everybody is equally responsible to make that happen. But again, like you said, everyone has different – she's stuck there anyway, right? Yeah. I mean,
I want to say something about the whole parenting other people's kids, because I think this can get to be a hot topic. And I think in certain circles, you're like never allowed ever to parent other people's kids. And I just don't agree with that, like as a blanket statement.
Yeah, I agree.
I think there's ways to talk to groups of kids, even kids that you're just meeting for the first time or that you don't hang out with very often. I think there's really respectful ways to talk to kids where – especially if there's one or two really conscientious or maybe a little bit more mature, less rowdy kids in that group who really might change their behavior with a little bit of a reminder. And I don't think that I really don't think that's overstepping bounds. I think sometimes parents overstep their bounds in parenting other people's kids for sure. But in a case like this, I just would use my like mama teacher voice and like, hey guys, you know, there's waiters coming through with hot food and we don't want anybody to get hurt or get spilled. So let's take this and move it over here, or let's play an I Spy game, or let's like, but again, if I had an 18-month-old that was my first kid and I had not been around big kids as much, I probably wouldn't have the confidence to do that. But now I would. I have no problem directing, telling a group of kids what to do.
And it doesn't offend me at all if someone else does that to
me neither. So, I think there's ways to do it that, you know, when it gets real personal or when you're intervening in an argument or something, I get why people get sensitive about that. But when you're just, when it's basic things like this.
Kid management. It's just,
It's just reminding, and kids need reminders. I think also one final thing too is when you have little ones, big kids can be kind of like a strange beast, right? Like they're just, if you don't have them, they're big and they're loud and they're noisy. And so the rowdiness seems almost even more magnified because you're not used to it. I don't know, Claire, I feel like, I hope we backed you up here because we've totally been there. The crappy situation. So I hope it didn't seem like we're taking the other side.
No, just not that, I'm not taking it. I'm not even taking a side. I'm saying, I tend to be more like Claire. I have compassion for everybody. And like you said, you don't know what was going on in anyone's mind. So I'd have no idea. I think in the future, if you have any say in the planning of something like this, maybe set everyone up for just better times.
And because, get a buddy too. If your if you're aligned with your spouse or one of the cousins is, you know, like a good buddy, you can say going in like, hey, last time this did not work for me. Like, let's see what we can do to make it different.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Claire, we hope that helps.
I hope that helps. And hopefully you don't have to do a family reunion dinner until you're the one who can sit back and enjoy your glass of wine. Okay. So we do have one more question, but before we do that, I wanted to jump in and remind people to take our listener survey if they have not already. We've had great responses and really in large numbers, which taking surveys is annoying. And now I do them when people ask, because I know that it's so important to get this information and find out more about who's listening. So if you haven't, it's right on our website at themomhour.com. And we would love to hear from you in that short survey. And then also another quick reminder to leave us an iTunes review if you have not already. We've gotten some really nice ones over the summer. We also heard from a listener who does not use any iTunes or Apple products. So her phone and her computer are not Apple. And she went through like an incredible circus to download iTunes and leave us a review, which I feel really bad because it's not that important. but if you are a pure Android or non-Mac Apple user and you're able to leave a review on one of your other podcast platforms, that's awesome. If not, you know, it's don't sweat it. Don't spend an hour.
But thank you so much to that.
I know. Thank you. It was so sweet. But if you are an Apple user and have an easy way to get into iTunes and leave us a review, it's a big help. All right. So moving on, do you want to set this one up from Amanda?
Are
you
looking at it? Yeah, I am. Okay. So Amanda's question is, my question is, did either of you co-sleep with your kids? Gabriel sleeps in bed with us, right or wrong, he does, and has since like 6 months. I never wanted to do it. I planned to have him in the crib right away, but it didn't happen. I just did something and like my screen jumped. When he was born, my husband worked the graveyard night shift, so I felt more comfortable with him closer to me so I could get up and nurse and be close if he needed anything. But now that we have switched roles and I work graveyard, it hasn't stopped. At home, when I sleep during the day, Gabriel naps with me, and at night, he sleeps in my bed with my husband. I know he's getting too old to co-sleep, and I know we need to transition him to his own crib, but I just don't even know how. We have the crib set up by our bed, but when we put him in there, he cries. We are struggling with a bedtime routine because my husband and I have abnormal lives and work schedules, so he is up usually until 10:30 or 11. By that point, we just want to get him in bed and asleep. Any advice here would be great.
And he's, I think Gabriel's 15 months, she said. He's 15 months. Just for the context.
So I was a long-term co-sleeper with all of my kids. I have been exactly where you are, Amanda, and I've been in the place where it's like too late to go back and start the other way. But almost also too late. It's like you get to that point where you have to decide, are we going to have some nights that really suck right now? Are we going to have them later?
Yeah.
Am I just going to wait this out and kind of have nights that, you know, like if you're getting okay sleep, is it worth just waiting it out until he's big enough to move him into a toddler bed or a bed that he feels more comfortable in? I mean, I hesitate to give really hard advice on this because it's so personal and people do sleep train. I mean, that's basically what you're doing, would be sleep training a 15 month old at this point, mm-hmm. because you'd be completely reshaping the way he falls asleep, mm-hmm. where he sleeps. It's a big mm-hmm. deal at that age. He's very used to what he's doing. Mm-hmm. One thing that I would do sometimes at that age, because that's when they start to get a little big and if they kick and it's not easy to sleep with them, is let them fall asleep with you and then move them into their crib. Mm-hmm. And I've read about people doing things like moving them, then moving the crib like slowly across the room and then out in the hall and then down the hallway. I mean, I've heard people going through these strategies. There was a book out and I want to say there was one that was for babies and it was – I think it was about – geared toward moms who co-slept or parents who co-slept. And then there was like a toddler version where they had some different strategies for getting around that. But I guess the question I come back to is, you say he's getting too old. Well, why? Is that because other people say that?
Yeah.
Is it because that's what you really think? Is it because you're not sleeping well? Is it because he's not sleeping well? I think that's your answer. If he's sleeping well, you're sleeping well, and you're fine with the arrangement, then other people don't. It's nobody's business.
Yeah,
I mean, no one's going to be coming in your bedroom at night, and, you know, Super Nanny is not going to be knocking at your door. I will also say that even though all five of my kids co-slept quite long, they all are fine. No, they're fine sleepers. One nice thing is they can kind of sleep anywhere, which is has been actually kind of nice. Like we travel a lot, we can visit family, and they can always find a place that they can easily fall asleep. So I don't know. I feel like I just rambled a whole bunch.
No,
I guess if I could give any advice, is just figure out why you want to change it and before you decide to change it.
Yeah. No, you said exactly what I was going to say, which is are you happy with the current arrangement? And if so, then I agree. I think that's the only thing that matters. I went to, when I was pregnant with my first, I went to this like a baby event, and there was a sleep person speaking who had a very gentle, you know, very gentle approach, but she was a sleep trainer, but she incorporated a lot of info for parents who chose to co-sleep. And her, one thing she said that stuck with me is there's a number of people who choose to co-sleep and choose to do it safely, and it's an intentional choice, and that is awesome. There are there's a big subsection of co-sleepers whose kids are in their bed because they haven't figured out any other way and who are not happy. And if you are one of those people, then here's some strategies. But if you are, if it's an intentional choice and it's what works, then end of story. There is no there is no solution needed. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And, you know, think about this from a global perspective. You know, Western culture is kind of unique in that we don't sleep next to our kids. I mean, that's it's just not really what we do here most of the time. Most people, it's not really accepted culturally, but worldwide, it's common. So I like to think about that sometimes when I'm thinking about what's right or wrong. It's sometimes nice to remember that we're not the only, you know, Americans and Westerners in general aren't the only people in the world, and we don't necessarily always have it all figured out. It's more about, like you said, like, how is it something you're doing because you want to do it or because it's working for you? No matter how you fell into it, a lot of people ended up co-sleeping just because they couldn't get any sleep any other way and they fell into it. But once you're there, do you have to stop just because it wasn't what you meant to do? Or, you know what I mean? Or is it better just to stick it out? I think it could go either way. The book I found, by the way, it's called The No Cry Sleep Solution. And the author's name is Elizabeth Pantley, but she has a version for toddlers, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
So then that's geared more toward, you know, like, so now here's a situation. I have a baby who won't go to sleep. He's, you know, 15 months old, who won't sleep through the night for wherever he's at. And she has solutions for that. And I thought it was a good book because it was very compassionate.
Yeah,
and not judgy at all. You know, regardless of where you are. Well, I also want to. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we'll link to that.
Okay,
we'll look it up and link to it. Go ahead.
Well, I was also going to say that I always want parents to keep in mind that that sleep is a huge industry in this country, and sleep solutions, sleep products, like there's a lot of incentive for people to always be coming up with new ways to get babies to sleep, and I guess the judgment or the lack of support for co-sleeping kind of goes along with that. Because if you just sleep with your baby in your bed and you like it, there's really no book. There's no system to be purchased. So I would just kind of like people to keep that in mind. Like sleep is one of those things. They're always still figuring out new things about new research. And no one's really totally got all the answers. And the different solutions, if you will, are as unique and as varied as the babies themselves and the families. So I don't know. I guess that's
I agree. I was going to say a couple more quick things. Number one, I didn't say when I started talking that I did not co-sleep with any of my babies. So you and I, it's one of our areas where we did things a little different, but I don't have any anti-co-sleeping feelings at all. I was also going to say that Amanda told us, she wrote us a great email where she went into detail about their very unconventional schedule. She does work an overnight graveyard shift and has to sleep during the day and doesn't really have childcare support during the day, a little bit. And then her husband's on duty during the day. And it was really beautiful the way they're making it work. And I would say when the schedule is a sort of looks different or non-traditional, and the time that you have with your kid is when you're also supposed to be sleeping and they are still napping a fair amount because they're little, I mean, to me, that it even more would make sense that you find a sleep solution that's just really natural with the rhythms yes. of your, you know, like it doesn't, yep. the books that advocate a 6:30 bedtime for your one-year-old who's going to sleep 12 hours and then you're all going to get up and go to daycare and work in school is not going to apply to you because that's right. not what your life looks like. So why should, you know, I would say that's a vote for really trusting what works because you already have this, unconventional schedule.
And it can be a really great bonding time, especially if you're, you know, spending time away from your baby during the day. Exactly. And it doesn't last forever. I mean, this is, we'll say this about any phase, right? But 15 months old, that you can start to feel like that is that year starts to drag, that second year, and it can really feel like this is never going to end. This is always going to be the way it is. And here we are to tell you, it will pass a lot more quickly than you would even anticipate. And you might get to a point where it's just not an issue. Like you can easily move him out of your bed and he's excited, you know, to move into this other bed. And so you don't have to put yourself through the ringer now unless there's a really compelling reason for
unless it's time, and you will know when it's time, like when nobody's getting any sleep and nobody's happy,
right?
It's time. I feel like that was always the prompt for when I needed to do some sleep training or shift something, was when we were all truly miserable, and then it's like, okay, well, we need to do something different because this isn't working. But from Amanda's email, that isn't the vibe that I was getting necessarily. And I think, I don't know because I didn't co-sleep, but I would imagine in the Elizabeth Pantley book and in other resources, there are still ways to help toddlers feel like there's a routine and a structure even, and maybe some expectations about sleep and falling asleep, even when you do co-sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, so if she's feeling like kind of she's got to be at the whim of when he's tired and then they all have to get in bed, I think there's probably some good strategies there for co-sleeping families to still put some routine and ritual around sleep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that that takes our time for today, but those were some awesome questions. And again, we love getting everybody's questions. You can email them to us at hello@themomhour.com. Love to know what listeners think of our answers because we went with a, you know, slightly more controversial topic.
Yeah, we sure did today. We're like really kind of branching out.
I know. Maybe we actually
putting ourselves out there. No. We had opinions, like real ones.
Real opinions. So Becky and Claire and Amanda, thank you so much for letting us go Dear Abby on you in this podcast.
Keep those speak pipes coming because I really love listening to those.
Really excited. And I've said it a million times, but I'll say it again, that if you feel awkward or shy about recording your own voice, you can delete it as many times as you want and you won't send us like a mess up because we mess up all the time. Like today we had to restart our recording. So if you have stage fright, it's a good system. So that's, I'll link to that in our show notes at themomhour.com too.
So. All right. Well, nice little short one today. It is the end of summer and we have vacations and all kinds of stuff going on. So we're doing a double header today.
So we will talk to everybody next week.
Next week.